right, I think we'll get started here tonight. Thank you all for coming. Representative Paul Thiessen from Minneapolis and Richfield. I'm chair of the Health and Human Services Policy Committee. And I think to get things started off, we'll have Representative Doty, who is kind enough to host us here today, start with some introductory remarks.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Welcome, everybody. We are extremely honored and extremely grateful to the members of the Health and Human Services Committee for being here with us. It's quite an honor to be chosen to represent rural Minnesota. We had two wonderful tours today, St. Gabriel's with their new facility, Horizon Health with their new facility, and I have an extremely pleasant job to do right now. I have an announcement to make. The Minnesota Department of Health, Office of Rural Health and Primary Care, today announced that they have awarded some grants. They totaled $3.5 million, which our legislature appropriated last year, to help Minnesota providers develop electronic patient health record systems. One of those grants, in the maximum amount that you asked for, Pat, goes to St. Gabriel's Hospital for $50,000. Congratulations. It'll be a nice addition to all that good stuff that we got to see on the tour. Thank you for that good tour, by the way. Once again, thank you to everybody for being here. We will waste no more of your time and turn it over to Chairman Thiessen and the work of the committee.
Thank you. And I think what we'll just do first is just run down who's here today so everybody has a sense. Mary Ellen, do you want to start? So we saw Tremor Road, is that?
I'm Representative Sandra Erickson. I represent Eastern Morrison County.
I'm Representative Julie Bunn. I represent District 56A, which is east of St. Paul from Stillwater down to Woodbury.
And I'm Representative Barron Murphy from St. Paul.
Representative Steve Gottwald from St. Cloud. I serve on this committee, the Finance Division, the other committee that's associated with this, as well as the Healthcare Access Commission and the Rural Health Advisory Board.
And I'm Representative Diane Lawson. I represent part of Minneapolis.
Hi, I'm Representative Joyce Puppet, and I currently represent 32A, which is the Rogers Maple Grove area and Vines Road community. But I'm a graduate of Little Falls High School, so I'm very familiar with this area.
I'm Matt Dean. I represent cities in northern Washington County, like Stillwater, Moline, Hugo, Matavidi, and my hometown, Delwood. And I want to thank you all for offering up an evening to spend with us today.
Well, I think what we're really trying to do on this, and we were in Hibbing yesterday and obviously spending time in Little Falls today, is to get a sense kind of out in the field. You know, we sit in St. Paul a lot and have hearings and talk about things, but it really helps us a lot to actually come out in the field, see facilities, see what's going on, and how healthcare is actually working on the ground in Minnesota. So thank you for affording us that opportunity. And we also have two presentations that may be of interest to folks here tonight as well that are kind of not focused just in Minnesota, but largely in Minnesota, on rural health care. And the first one, the first presenter is Dr. Alana Knutson from North Dakota, University of North Dakota? Yes, in Grand Forks. And I think the findings of the study they did of Minnesota farm and ranch, well, farm families primarily, I suppose, in Minnesota, but are actually really interesting, what their access to health care is, what it means to their family budgets to have, health emergencies or health issues. And so just to kind of give us some overall context, Dr. Knutson.
Thank you for inviting me to come and share our research with all of you, and also thank you for inviting me into your community. I have been overwhelmingly impressed with the beautiful facilities and even more so with the hospitality of all of you. So thank you for inviting a Westerner to today's discussions. As Chairman Thiessen said, this study is a study of farm and ranch operators, and it was done in 7 states, and I'll just begin with an overview of who was involved. First of all, the Access Project, which is based in Boston, and you may say, now what is a Boston project interested in doing in the Midwest, especially in Minnesota and North Dakota. Well, the Access Project Director is Mark Rukavina, who, of course, is a native of northern Minnesota. So he has some very interesting ties and clearly some interest in this arena. But the Access Project that he directs is actually a national research and advocacy organization, and they do a great deal of work looking at how to strengthen communities and provide technical assistance so communities can be empowered to make their communities a healthier place to live. They get funding originally from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, but now they primarily are funded through grants and projects such as this one. I am located at the Center for Rural Health, which is at the UND School of Medicine and Health Sciences. And what we do at the center, which is almost 30 years old now, we really focus on education, training. We do a lot of resource awareness, similar to the things that were announced today. We provide funding to rural communities and a lot of assistance in helping to make rural North Dakota as healthy a place as we possibly can. And we also do things on a national level, trying to impact rural policies that make a difference for our rural communities, in particular, the health of our rural communities. I myself work in the area of rural health research and policy. We also have another partner in this, and this is the Schneider Institute at Brandeis University, and they're the group that actually did a lot of the statistical analysis for us. This project actually started kind of in concept in 2006 when the Access Project went to Kansas and, in partnership with the Kansas Farmers Union, did a survey of farmers in that state looking at issues pertaining to health insurance and medical debt. And this report, entitled Losing Ground, was published in July of 2006. And I happened to see that report, and I called them, and I said, you know, we are really interested in the very same issues that you folks are researching. Would there be a chance that we could partner with all of you? And what do you think Mark said? Absolutely. Let's give it a try and see what we can do. And less than 6 months later, we were on our way with private and public funding to be able to conduct this research. So what did we do, and what have we looked at? First of all, we looked at seven different states. We looked at Minnesota, Montana, North Dakota, Nebraska, Missouri, and Iowa. And in those states, we partnered with the state offices of rural health. And in Minnesota here, we had a chance to partner with Mark Schoenbaum. And what's been really fun about this project is that we got information from the people in your state who have a really good pulse on some of the real pertinent issues pertaining to health insurance, medical debt, and some of the issues that are really very relevant to rural providers. So we were able to gain some of the insights of people who know very intimately what's going on in the rural health of these seven states. And the primary purpose then for us to do this study was to look at the financial burden of health insurance and health care, and also look at how health insurance impacts access to care, and in some cases, how that insurance product may even contribute to people considering delaying their care. So how did we go about this, and what did we do? First of all, we gathered information about health insurance coverage. We wanted to know what kind of health insurance did they have, how did they get their health insurance? Did they get it through employers? Did they get it through the individual health insurance market? Or did they use different kinds of public available health insurance products? How much did they pay for health insurance? As we know, health insurance costs continue to grow up, and many incomes do not keep pace with the inflation that we see in the health care premiums that most people are needing to pay. We also were very interested in the amount of deductibles that people had, because as we know, a lot of times what has happened as health insurance premiums have gone up, the amount of deductibles also have gone up. So the coverage has actually become less, even though the cost of insurance has become more. We were specifically interested in what those out-of-pocket costs are, things regarding co-insurance, co-payments, those types of things, as well as looking at medical debt. And medical debt has been studied a lot in our country recently. In particular, the Commonwealth Fund has done a national survey looking at medical debt. But we really wanted to find out, how is this impacting farm and ranch families, because these people, in particular, they're small business owners. So a lot of the experiences that farm and ranch families have are also analogous to the experiences that small business owners are also facing. And again, we were looking at that issue of impact to healthcare, as well as what some of the financial consequences were for that health insurance and the issue of not enough health insurance. So what can we learn from this data? Well, first of all, we know unequivocally there is a direct relationship between health insurance and the kind of health insurance you have and the kind of access to care that you have. We also know that there are a lot of out-of-pocket costs. And what we did in our findings or our survey was to develop it so that we could not only look at hospital and healthcare provider costs, but we also asked questions of dental and pharmaceuticals, because we know that those areas also impact families a great deal. And in some cases, they may or may not have coverage that provides additional support to pay for services, for dental services or prescription drugs. We also know that there is an influence of the cost of health insurance and the cost of health care on their farm and ranch operations. So how did we do this? We contracted with the USDA National Agricultural Statistical Services, and we contracted with the folks in actually in Fargo at NDSU, which people at UND don't like me to say out loud, but I use that four-letter term. Anyway, NDSU, the North Dakota State University, and they worked with the national folks at USDA to help us develop a sample that would be representative not only of all seven states, but also a representative sample for each individual state. So we have individual information, and I'll be sharing some of that information about what we learned from the Minnesota farmers. What we ended up doing then was developing a survey tool using different questions that have been asked on a national basis so we can make some comparisons to see what we've learned so there's something comparable. And then we tested it with some farmers and ranchers to see if we were on base. So after this was tested, we went out into the field, and guess what time frame we collected this data? February, March. You know why that is. What are farmers and ranchers doing in February or March? Not as much. They're getting ready to get out in the field in the spring. So we were very fortunate to have that opportunity to collect that data at that perfect time of the year for farm and ranchers. And we had almost an 80% response rate, which is excellent. We had over 2,000 farmers and ranchers that participated in this survey. So we feel really confident about the information that we were able to get in terms of being able to get a good pulse of what's going on in our farm and ranch communities. So I'll switch then to what we found out. What did we learn? Specifically, what did we learn about Minnesotans? We had 266 respondents from Minnesota, and so this first bit of information I'm going to share with you is specific to the farmers that we heard from calling in Minnesota. And what we found, which wasn't very different, I have to say all seven of these states were very much similar in the kind of responses that we had and the kind of makeup of the people that we talked to. The majority of our farm and ranch operators were male, 94%. Most of them were Caucasian. Two-thirds of them were married. And 83% of them were over the age of 44. And you can see on that pie chart that if you look overall, there aren't a whole lot. In fact, there's only 17% of farmers in this state that are under the age of 44. So we're dealing with an aging population similar to some of the other issues that we're looking at in rural communities, especially that rural workforce. And by the way, this is a farmstead from the Waseca area. So this is a Minnesota farm that I was able to capture off the internet. And we asked farm and ranchers, what is your principal occupation? Now, I have to say up front, there's a bias here because I grew up on a farm myself, and I know a lot of the people in our community had to work off the farm, and so we really wanted to find out if that was happening all over the country. And what we found here in Minnesota was that over half of the people who responded did not have were ranching and farming as their principal occupation, but 42% of them said they had off-farm jobs. So that's a very high percentage of people who are not able to be fully engaged in their agricultural occupation. We also asked questions about income. And as you can see, the majority of these people had incomes between $40,000 and just under $100,000. We had about a third of the people indicate that their incomes were less than $40,000. And just a small percent, about 15%, said their incomes were over $100,000. Now, this is somewhat higher than the average household incomes of the people in the state. So I just want to give you a note that these people, in some ways, are somewhat better off than the average people in the state. So I want you to think about that as we start looking at some of the other results. But clearly, we still have a third of these people that do have incomes less than $40,000. We also asked them questions about their health status. How healthy are these people? And what we learned was the Minnesota farm and ranch operators are about as healthy, in fact, identically as healthy, as what we find on national surveys. And as you can see, 62% said that they were in excellent or very good health. About a third of them, again, said that they were in good health, and a small percentage, 7%, said they were in fair to poor health. Now, we know that farming in particular is quite a physically demanding occupation, and so it's likely that people that did have poor health had to probably get out of farming because they couldn't maintain that kind of an occupation if they weren't in good health. We also asked questions about their health insurance. Now, as you can see, 94% of Minnesota farm and ranch operators indicated that they had health insurance. Only 2% said that they were uninsured for the entire year. Another small percent, about 4%, said that somebody in their household did not have health insurance at some time during the prior year. Now, this is a very high coverage, if you will, of people. When you look overall, 94% is very high. And again, this is very common in all seven Midwest states. So what we're seeing is that farm and ranch operators are in particular very used to getting health insurance and having health insurance. Now, anecdotally, I know that there are some banks, for example, that require proof of health insurance if one is to be able to get an operating loan. However, there is no stipulation as to what kind of insurance or what level of coverage that they have. They just have to demonstrate that they have some health insurance. So what this tells you is that people have insurance. It doesn't tell you about the quality of that health insurance. And have all of you heard of the term underinsured? It doesn't take that issue of underinsurance at all into effect. It's solely looking at people who said they have some kind of health insurance. So then we asked, where did you get your health insurance? And 59% of these people indicated that they got their health insurance either through their employer or through their spouse's employer. And that, again, was not only common to Minnesota, but to all seven states. And again, as small business, you can tell that people are needing or seeking to get into groups to be able to get health insurance. About one-third of these people actually purchased their insurance through the individual market or as their own family unit. And we know that that insurance is usually more expensive, more difficult to get, and also usually includes some kind of pre-existing conditions, and it's also rated by age. And if you recall, remember, the vast majority of the people who responded to this survey were over the age of 44. And as you start getting into the increasing ages, you also have premiums that increase as well, because there's a direct connection between how old a person is and the cost of health insurance. Those premiums go up as people age. A very small percent indicated that they had health insurance through Medicare, Medicaid, and the Veterans Administration. So then we asked the people who didn't have health insurance, and remember that's a very small number, and we asked them, why don't you? And 3 out of 4 of these people indicated they did not have health insurance because they could not afford it. And one of the comments from one of the respondents was, costs are outrageous and all insurance is outrageous for what we put in and for what we get out of it. We also asked some questions about medical debt, because this is gaining a lot of interest in national policymaking. In fact, there are some states that have done analyses on the bankruptcies in their states, and we have some states where the number one issue for bankruptcy, or the number one reason why people go into bankruptcy, is due to medical debt. And I don't know what that is for Minnesota. That would be something for me to look into. But still, we found that even with people with these higher income levels, even with people that have, for the most part, 94% of these people are insured, 1 out of 5 still told us that they have medical debt. And almost half of those people had medical debt that they owed to a primary care provider, such as a physician or nurse practitioner, PA, or what have you. The other debts were primarily for hospital and for dental care. Now, you may ask, how does this impact? You know, what does this mean? Well, you know, in rural communities, we are also interconnected. And we know that medical debt is a financial burden for families. But likewise, it's also a financial burden for those health care providers, because we know, especially in rural communities, they operate on a very slim margin. And when you are operating on that slim margin and you're carrying debt, and remember, this is debt for people that, on average, have higher incomes. So you know that other people in the community also have debt. It makes it very difficult to be able to sustain your health care systems. And the viability of rural health is really interdependent upon our ability as patients and consumers of that health to be able to pay for it. So this kind of information is very important, not only for farmers and ranchers, but also for healthcare providers, because healthcare providers need income to be able to maintain their services. We also pulled a few quotes that are directly from some of the Minnesota farmers, and I'll just share a couple with you. One was, we just make the deductible this year and the year is over. So we really never benefit from having the health insurance. We are paying everything at 100%. If the deductibles were lower and the cost not so high, it would benefit the farmers and ranchers. Some also suggested that they had to get, their husband had to get an off-farm job to obtain health insurance coverage. And actually, that is something that we heard from a lot of people in many states, the importance of that off-farm employment to be able to get into group health insurance. And you have the handout, and if you don't, we'll make sure that you do. You can see some of the other comments that were made. Now, this part of the presentation includes comments that came from all 7 states. So these aren't just Minnesota. These represent all 7 states. And again, I just want to emphasize, when we looked at the data, there is hardly any difference when you compare from state to state. We heard almost the same thing. I think us Midwesterners operate in very much the same way. And what we heard when we asked the question about, do you have a financial burden pertaining to your health care? 1 in 4 of our farm and ranch operators said that they did, and they said that health care costs contribute to some of their financial problems. And what results from these problems? Some of them are forced to take off-farm employment. Some of them delay making investments in their farms. Some of them have difficulty paying other bills. And some of them have difficulties paying their rent and mortgage. One person in particular commented that it also has impact on a future generation or their next generation because their insurance costs forced us not to help our kids in college and we had to get more loans. We also asked, how do they pay for health care costs? One out of four indicated that they had to draw on other resources to pay their health care costs. And these other resources included family savings, credit card debt, borrowing against their home or farm, and also withdrawing money from their retirement account. And again, one person's comment was, it took most of my wife's income to pay our medical bills last year. And in fact, we even had one person who, from the state of Iowa, Mark and I were part of an interview, and she said that they have an ongoing debt of about $20,000 a year that just keeps rolling from year to year. We also then asked questions about delaying care. And 43% of our farm operators said that they delayed care. And when we asked why, 70% of them, the majority of them, said that they delayed care because they couldn't afford the cost of care. Now, we know that farm and ranch is also seasonal employment, so we said, what are these reasons? Are there other reasons that might be forcing you to delay care? And, of course, the demands of farm work came up as one, but another one was their discomfort of already owing money to their health care provider. They did not feel comfortable accessing more health care. So where are we now? We are now in the process of developing another brief. The first brief that we've developed is on the table if you haven't had a chance to get it, and it's also available on our websites if you want to download it or what have you. And the next brief that we're going to issue that talks more about our survey is actually based on looking at the value that people are getting for their health insurance products. And we think that that's going to be very, very useful because there's a lot of discussion about health insurance products that have basic coverage and then high deductibles, trying to induce that consumer demand, looking at consumer-driven health care. And what we're really looking at is, are people getting value if they're buying those kinds of health plans? And what kind of financial risk are people putting themselves into when they purchase different types of health insurance and looking at the differences between people who purchase in the group market versus those who purchase in the individual market. And we really look at this information not only being informing of farm and ranch operators, but also helping to guide some of the discussion when we look at small business, because these are issues that are very similar that they face, too, when you have a small business trying to figure out ways to cover yourself and maybe one or two employees. But stay tuned. We'll have more information yet to come. And if you need to contact us or would like to contact us, our contact information is listed. It's in your handout. And we would be most welcome to hearing your comments and providing you more information. Are there any questions that I could answer?
Representative Trump.
I just have one. You did identify that the public program as Medicare, and there might have been another one. Yes. Minnesota Care wasn't identified by line. Did that get folded into the Medicaid numbers? Or?
We actually had it separate, but we had very few respondents in that. So for this presentation, we just put it all together.
I'm assuming this, but you use the Schedule F, I would assume, for the gross income or net income of the farmers' wages?
We asked the same question about their income as the USDA asks on all of their other surveys. We tried to make it consistent, and I can't exactly remember what it is, but I believe it is their net income. Mm-hmm. Absolutely, and that is yet to come. You are biting at the bit. We're going to get that one out here very soon. And You know, one of the things, too, I've worked with a few of these surveys looking at health insurance coverage, and one of the things that we continue to learn and are continually reminded of is that people really don't know their health insurance unless they have to use it. So we get actually some of the best information from people who actually have had some health issues which have necessitated them hitting those deductibles and looking at some of those co-insurance and some of those out-of-pocket things.
Did any of them have health savings accounts? Did either of you get that information?
Absolutely. We've got it all.
That's good.
Mm-hmm. I think Matt, Representative Dean has a question.
Just a question from the other night that came up. We're talking a lot about people who own farms and farm owners and farm changes. What about people who work on farms, particularly the immigrant population? What about
transport? We did not. They were not included as part of this. This is the farmers that are the operators that are, I don't know if you call it registered with the USDA, but are the people responsible for the acreage and the livestock information that's reported to the USDA. But that is another population that we would very much like to get information about, but it's very difficult to get that.
If they were covered by Medicare, is it because they were over 62? Do you know?
Yes, and we try to limit this to 65 and older. We just hit a few age pockets where their birthdays happen to kind of creep into where we are. So, yes, these were all 65 and older.
Under.
65 and older. We tried to cut people off at 65, but for Medicare, the ones that we had were all 65 and older. We did not have anybody, for example, that had renal dialysis. We did not have those in our sample. Probably because if they had that kind of health problem, they wouldn't maybe be able to farm.
Any other questions at this point? Okay. Well, and if you have questions later, I think you can stay to the next presentation. Okay.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Our next presenter is from the Minnesota Department of Health, Mark Schoenbaum, who was talked about earlier. And they have just issued, the Office of Rural Health, is that what it is? Yes. Has just issued a report on some of their thoughts and observations, that group, and how what's happening in rural Minnesota ties into the state health reform efforts that are going on this summer and fall. And just for people's backgrounds, last session, the legislature actually established two groups, really, and gave them the charge of coming up with a plan to get to universal coverage by 2011 and also try to get some significant savings, cost savings in our health system. One is a governor's task force, and then there's a legislative group. And their findings will be reported here in January. But I think what this report, part of it was intended to do is to try to bring a rural perspective to that discussion. So why don't you go ahead? Thanks.
Thank you, Representative Thiessen. And again, it's great to be here, great to be in Little Falls. I'm Mark Schoenbaum from the Office of Rural Health and Primary Care. We are part of the State Health Department. Our charge is to work to maintain and improve access to quality health care for citizens of rural Minnesota and its underserved urban areas as well. And one of the ways we do our work is with the guidance of governor-appointed Rural Health Advisory Committee. And given the trends that Representative Thiessen mentioned with all the emphasis on health care reform, that committee and two of its members are with us tonight. It has two members from the House and two members from the Senate. And the members from the House are Representative Mary Ellen Otremba and Representative Steve Gottwald. So it is great to have both of you here tonight. And you've been part of this, although you missed the meeting where we adopted it, so feel free to ask questions with everybody else. The group, as Representative Thiessen mentioned, with health reform in the wind in Minnesota and with much activity going on, both under the governor's auspices and the legislature's auspices, that committee, which is charged to advise the Commissioner of Health and other state agencies on rural health issues, thought the time was right, and it would be important to provide a rural perspective on the impact and the possibilities for health care reform. The committee has 15 members appointed by the governor. There are providers, there are consumers, there are representatives of rural higher education and legislators, as we have mentioned. The committee convened a work group last summer to look at rural health care reform, and you have, there were copies of the report as you came in. The report was just issued last week. The work group finished its work at the beginning of September. The Rural Health Advisory Committee adopted the report just recently. To begin its work, the work group and the committee thought it would be important to provide some background information and some landscape on what makes rural different. And these are points and characteristics that are familiar to all of you here. Rural Minnesota covers 80% of the land area of the state, and depending on how you count it, has 30 to 40% of the state's population. Demographically, rural tends to be different. The population tends to be older. Incomes tend to be somewhat lower. There are health status differences. With that older population comes a greater share of chronic disease, which much of which ends up in our health care system. There are health coverage differences, which you've just heard a lot about, and it's interesting that the characteristics in Minnesota are similar to those of our neighboring states. And there's growing diversity in rural Minnesota. As I came in this evening and we were setting up, I noticed a report, which again, most of you have probably seen it, and I should have seen, issued by the Initiative Foundation on the changing face of central Minnesota, which documents, it's an excellent report, I had a chance to look through it before the meeting, which documents the changing population and the changing face of this part of rural Minnesota, and similar changes are underway across the state. Distance, as we all know, given that large landmass, is an issue. And those of us that have been driving around the last couple of days, you know, I'll kind of make the same point I made again last night. Kind of, what would we do? What would happen if the car ran off the road, you know, in between, you know, some of our larger rural communities? And the other question that occurred to me as I was driving today is, you know, what would happen for my mother or my grandmother if she lived in that house, kind of off the road between some of our rural health facilities? So those are issues in rural Minnesota. All those create workforce challenges, which we'll talk about, and challenges to our health care facilities. The positive side of this is that there's a long, long history of creativity and collaboration in rural Minnesota, responding certainly to health care and to other issues as well. And I'm always very impressed and blown away when I have the opportunity to be out in rural Minnesota and see and learn more about rural health facilities. The two places we went today, St. Gabriel's and Horizon Health, you're blessed with absolutely fantastic organizations in this part of the state. They're the question that every that we all ask is, would I want to go there or would I want my family members to go there? No question with the places we've seen the last couple of days. Wide variety of providers in rural Minnesota, small, medium, and large, and different ownership characteristics as well. So the work group and the committee thought it was important to paint this picture for people from all of the different parts of the health system and all the different leadership areas that are looking at health reform. Having painted this picture, which I'll talk a little bit more about, forgot this slide here, includes economic differences, many of which have been talked about in the last presentation, and you can see them summed up here. Another important difference in rural Minnesota is that health care is a much larger part of the economic structure and the employment base in many rural communities. All right. So having laid out the landscape and thinking about health care reform, the work group and the committee put forth the series of options and recommendations, which you will find in more detail in the report. And given the work going on in St. Paul, the recommendations are organized according to the framework that one of the health reform bodies, the Healthcare Transformation Task Force, is using to develop its work as well. And I will go through these in some detail, but here they all are as a group. I'll just pause on the last one. Something that we find often in rural Minnesota is that all of the healthcare services, or many of the healthcare services, are co-located on the same campus, often in the same building, different wings of the same building. That presents, it's kind of done out of necessity, but it also presents opportunities both for efficiency, which we heard about work here going on, both at St. Gabriel's and at Horizon, always efficiency in mind. And it also presents opportunities for coordinating care, improving quality, important goals in health reform. The work group came up with a recommendation on health coverage that I was surprised. I was surprised they went this direction, which is to work towards universal coverage. They came at it, arrived at it through no particular philosophical bent, but looking at all of the challenges to delivering affordable health coverage with the characteristics of the rural economy, small businesses, individuals, self-employed, lower incomes, part-time work. Things have been tried over the last 10 to 15 years to try and address those challenges one at a time, and not a lot of progress has been made. So looking back at that and looking at those challenges, the group kind of defaulted towards a recommendation to move, if possible, towards universal coverage as kind of the only thing that was left that might be effective at providing affordable, wide coverage. However, being realists, they did acknowledge that in the meantime, many of the things that have been tried and some new ideas must continue to be pursued to make things better, if possible, while in hopes that things will move towards universal coverage. There was talk earlier about the benefits of belonging to a group that can seek insurance coverage as a group. Some of these recommendations apply to making that more possible for people to join groups in rural areas. There's a recommendation about Minnesota Care directed at the situation that farm families can find themselves in, where by income they may be eligible for the program, but the farmland asset excludes them. And I know, Representative Lookrum, but you've worked on that a lot. So those are their recommendations about coverage. And I think they, although working on two parallel tracks, the analysis of the folks in Minnesota and of the broader survey out of the University of North Dakota, I think, end up at similar places. But coverage isn't everything. To get the improvements in cost, quality, and access that those looking at health reform have set their eyes on, there are a number of other parts of the system that need improvements as well. Technology is clearly important, and there are a set of recommendations here. One of them has to do with the workforce needed if small facilities are going to make the technology changes needed. And there was also an interest in expanding support for telehealth technology, whether telemedicine, patients communicating by video directly with a healthcare provider, using telehealth for people in remote locations who need home care assistance or through trading images electronically. There's going to need to be enough healthcare workers to deliver the services to get the quality improvements that everyone is after. And let's spend a little bit of time looking at health workforce. Here's just kind of some facts about health occupations in the state. The largest group, and it's has multiple occupations within it, is at the bottom, which is allied health. And very important and issues there. But when we're talking about improving healthcare quality, looking at primary care, the place where folks tend to go first, we're generally thinking about doctors and nurses. And so just keep in mind that there are about 50,000 nurses in the state and about 12,500 physicians. As with any resource, it's not distributed evenly. And whether one is looking at medical care, dental care, or mental health care, there are shortages both within rural Minnesota and within parts of the Twin Cities as well. Again, there's been a lot of discussion in the health reform forums about the importance of using primary care to meet our quality goals and to serve as the foundation of a medical home. So I want to talk for a little bit about primary care workforce in Minnesota. As you can see, there are fewer primary care physicians for the population proportionally in rural areas than in urban areas. Micropolitan is kind of a big rural area. So the same phenomenon applies not quite as extremely there. So fewer physicians per population, primary care physicians per population. However, if you look at the right-hand pie on this chart, primary care is a much larger share of the physician workforce in rural Minnesota. So they are expected to carry a lot of load. And the flip side of that is there are fewer specialists generally in rural areas. Physicians are getting older, as are nurses. And nurses and other health practitioners tell us that a surprising number of them are planning to retire by the time the next 10 years has passed. Nurse practitioners and physician assistants are important primary care providers. Here's just some facts and figures about those types of providers. Keep in mind there are 12,500 physicians, 50,000 nurses. These are an essential, but at this point, relatively modest part of the total healthcare workforce. And if we look at other health occupations, we find similar characteristics regarding distribution, age, retirement plans. So what do we do about all this? A model that can be helpful to look at is called the workforce development pipeline. And it begins on the left with preparing kids for health careers and interesting them in entering health careers training, recruiting them into that training, locating training, and providing the type of training that will equip them and interest them in working where they are needed. Once they come out of training, they're going to have lots of options. And so we need to think about how we can encourage new grads to work where they are needed. And once they're there, we have to figure out how to keep them there. Again, I think these are all challenges that you're familiar with here. One analogy that you can think of this pipeline, I can often think of it as a kind of a manufacturing, with a manufacturing analogy in mind. So the left-hand parts of the pipeline are kind of about production, producing more workers, and the right-hand parts are about distribution, getting them where they're needed. And we can increase production through a variety of activities. And again, you've got some of that going on here. The state's involved, MNSCU is involved, the University of Minnesota, and healthcare facilities themselves are involved. I think all of us were very impressed this afternoon when we were at Horizon about the Grow Your Own training program, the classroom in the new building, that the goals and the potential and the hopes you have for that program, very impressive and an absolutely essential part of meeting our workforce needs. So we need to do more of everything we're doing. Another analogy I like to use about workforce is comparing it to fishing and kind of the fish in the lake. We have to be the best fishermen we can be. Recruiting, there are a variety of activities going on there. Currently, all good, and I think people in this community are plugged in to those. And there again, we need to do more. I'll keep moving here. Regarding training, you can see what's going on the left there. The biggest challenges that we hear about for, again, with kind of manufacturing in mind, for producing the healthcare workforce that we need is the shortage of faculty members, particularly in nursing, and it's a daunting shortage, particularly given, again, all of the options that nurses have for work settings and earnings choices, and expanding clinical training sites so that people can get the in-the-field training that they need during their programs. So we can increase production. We can also increase distribution. Whoops. And on the left, you can see some of the strategies in current use. On the right, there are some new things we can try. One thought that I'm starting to hear more and more is that, looking at that second bullet on the right there, that the greater breadth that rural physicians, rural nurses are called on to respond to and to be skilled in maybe should lead us to thinking about having specialties for those fields. So perhaps a rural medicine or rural nursing curriculum and designation that would better equip people, again, and maintain their interest in moving into those settings. And we need to retain people once they are there. And again, here today, we heard about the aging of the nursing workforce and the physician workforce. And we also heard about and saw some in the new hospital, some of the built-in design features that will improve safety and reduce injuries, both for patients, number one, but also for the staff as a way to keep people from being injured and keep them on the job. So we need to be the best fishermen we can be, but there probably aren't enough fish left in the lake to solve our problem. And just a couple of illustrations of that. This chart represents the trends in medical students going into primary care specialties. And I'll direct your attention to the darker bar, which is family practice. And I think we heard last night this trend only goes through 2003, and you can see it's going in the wrong direction. But we heard last night, I believe, that in the last 4 or 5 years, entrance into family practice residencies have dropped 60%. Is that what we heard last night? I hadn't heard it that bluntly before. It's pretty scary. Putting all of this together, we've seen that our current workforce is old, aging. I shouldn't say old. They're aging. They're getting old. And looking at this graph, you can see that kind of has the negative part of this chart here represents the physicians and nurses who are going to be leaving practice as they retire or change careers. the production of new graduates to replace them, that trend is flat at the same time that the population is aging and will be using more medical services. Alana and I were talking about this earlier. What term did you use for this? Train wreck or something like that? So there's a problem here, and we probably can't train our way out of it. But what, so what do we do? And here's where I think kind of just the trends in workforce present not just a challenge but an opportunity as we look at health reform. We need to add a new component to redesign healthcare jobs and to redesign how we deliver healthcare. Not just so that we can do it with the workforce we're going to have, but so that we improve quality and lower costs at the same time. We can look at who does what within the health professions, and we may find some opportunities to rearrange job assignments there. That tends to get very controversial very fast, and a lot of factors, including the ones I've listed here, have to line up for those involved to be interested in making changes, but it deserves to be considered. And we can redesign how we deliver health care. In terms of changing who does what, one example of that you have here in Little Falls, although St. Gabriel's is a critical access hospital and is fortunate to have physicians at the hospital 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, if needed, and this happens in some other communities, nurse practitioners and physician assistants are allowed to staff the hospital and staff the emergency room in this type of small hospital. So that's, I think, something that bears looking at perhaps in other settings. Medication therapy management is a type of service provided by qualified pharmacists to integrate them more into the primary care team, and that holds a lot of potential as well. I've talked about some of these already, and it's interesting at Horizon today, looking on the right-hand side of the chart, when we were walking through the building and learning about what the staff did, we learned that everybody does everything, pretty much. And the technical term for that is the universal worker, which I think you're ahead of the curve there. And I think, again, that's a trend that's going on here that holds promise elsewhere as well. In areas that are not as fortunate to have the physician availability that you have here, we are seeing, as this article from Missouri shows, it says, nurse-owned clinics replace country doctors. We are seeing just that start to happen. And this, for those of you that are familiar with the recent phenomena of what are called minute clinics, is kind of the move of the minute clinic idea into rural areas. Largely out of necessity, but helps solve a problem. I'm going to close here by talking about some national thinking on healthcare quality and health reform. The Institute of Medicine is a national body under the National Academy of Sciences that works full-time analyzing and thinking about how to improve healthcare. They published this report on the left here, Crossing the Quality Chasm, in the late 90s, which was the first report that became well-known and newsworthy looking at how to improve patient safety and healthcare quality. This was the report, you may remember the headlines, that reported that up to 98,000 people a year were being killed in hospitals through medical errors. That got everybody's attention. And many improvements have been made, including such simple things as marking surgery sites with magic markers so the surgery takes place on the right part of the body. The Institute of Medicine, in looking at patient safety and healthcare quality, a couple years later turned its attention to rural America and ask the same question. If we want to improve quality, reduce medical errors, improve safety in rural America, what should the approach be? And they came up with an answer that, that this group has heard me say several times, but I'm still surprised that this was the approach that the Institute of Medicine developed. They did say you need to work on clinical quality improvement, the wrong side surgery improvements, medication errors. You need to work on all of those activities that they are recommending for the entire health system, and you find their wording on that in number two. But they said to make this work in rural Minnesota, you really need a comprehensive, holistic, multi-part approach. You need to look at the individuals, and you need to look at health at the community level. You need to look at workforce, which we spent some time talking about, not just the healthcare professional workforce, but looking at human resources, you need to involve people in taking responsibility for their own health and being part of the solution. You need to make sure that rural healthcare providers, and we heard some findings from the previous study, rural healthcare providers that have challenges serving small numbers of people across large areas can be financially fragile, and you need to pay attention to that and make sure that they are financially healthy so that they can deliver the quality that we're after. And finally, you need to invest in communications and information technology. And we saw some good examples of that at the new St. Gabriel's Day. Very impressive work. So this is a national look, and it's interesting, again, to me, that it takes the same direction as the Rural Health Advisory Committee and its health reform work group took in Minnesota. And I'll just kind of leave you kind of with those thoughts that we need to keep in mind the unique characteristics of rural Minnesota. And if we do so, we can make progress on all of these interrelated healthcare reform goals. And I'll turn it back to you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much. Are there any brief questions? Okay.
Excellent point. And if you would email me a little summary about that, I'll make sure that we kind of can carry that forward as well.
This one over here.
Thank you.
Well, I think that's a good point. It's something we hear about quite a bit at the legislature, and you know, trying to figure out ways that we can impact that. Obviously, some of our rates could have something to do with that, but we have our own budgetary constraints to think about. But I think that ties into one of the points in rural. One of the things that we're hearing, I think, on this trip is that living wage that, or the wages that we pay to these workers, because 20% of the workforce is in health care in rural Minnesota, which is a surprising statistic. I mean, that has implications not just for that person, but for the whole community. You know, if we can pay real wages to the medical folks, you know, that does a lot more for everybody else who they would go and shop from, and all those things. So that's actually one of the things that's been most enlightening to me on this trip.
And that's one of the things we discussed extensively at the advisory committee. You can have all the pipeline you want, but if at the end of that pipeline you don't have a good-paying job, they're not going to come out or stay out in our rural areas, whether they're nurse practitioners, MDs, nurses' assistants, you name it. If you want more and better health care providers in rural areas, you have to make it a viable option for them from a career standpoint.
I think thank you very much for those comments. I think that's very helpful. I think in the interest of time, we're going to move to our next presenter, which actually, it's Lauren Olson and Dennis Dolan from the Healthy Communities Collaborative, and they've done work. Some of you may know them well, but they've done some work. I think it'll be really useful for us in Morrison County. Some of the similar issues, but right here. And so, gentlemen, whenever it works for you.
Sure. Mark gives up the microphone. He's trying to get the screen up.
Well, Dr. I'll ask that we just address some of the things that we've been hearing. And then when I talked to Jen from the committee, she said, we'd like to hear some of the things that you're doing. But whatever you do, do it in less than 10 minutes. So we will try to accomplish that. The Healthy Communities Collaborative of Morrison County exists to build and nurture the physical, mental, spiritual, and economic well-being of the community by connecting resources that will facilitate health and well-being for the people of Morrison County. We were able to organize in 2002 with a planning grant from the Catholic Health Initiatives, the parent organization of Unity Family Health Care, and spent a significant amount of time drawing people together at forums and in committees, listening to the concerns of people in our area, as well as identifying assets, you know, strengths and resources that we can draw upon to promote quality of life. It has been an exciting process, and we don't have a lot of time to talk about it, but we'll do a brief overview of the collaborative and then have our executive director, Dennis, tell about one of our more successful projects, the Bridges Program. So we have heard the common concern shared across the state for livable wage jobs, which relates to a broad spectrum of issues, including the reality that too many people in our county hold jobs that do not qualify for employer-sponsored health insurance, and even many who do cannot afford the premiums for that insurance. Our Economic Development Committee works in partnership with other community organizations to address this issue, as is presently in the process of submitting a grant for a project that we hope will further prepare our young people for the workplace, and through some of the job shadowing stuff and things that we have envisioned, this project could again help recruit people for the healthcare industry. The people we have listened to continue to raise education and lifelong learning as important facets of health and wellness, and feel that it is important to involve the broader community in educational efforts, whether it's the traditional three R's, science and technology, or opportunities to learn about health and wellness, such as dealing with diabetes or smoking cessation, or simply the ongoing learning processes that promote good emotional health. Our Alcohol and Tobacco Committee has been active on its own and in partnership with other community organizations to provide educational messages about the health risks of chemical abuse, including the locally made "So What's the Big Deal?" video that addresses underage drinking, and the widely distributed brochure "Major Decisions for Minor Drinking." This committee is looking at becoming part of a larger coalition to address drug, alcohol, and tobacco concerns on a county-wide basis. But, of course, even with our efforts and all of the efforts, we continue to hear community concerns about youth, drugs, and drinking, and even broader cultural attitudes that encourage unhealthy chemical use. And our new healthcare committee has been organized in response to a task force that studied issues of healthcare accessibility and affordability in our area. The task force looked at insurance issues, availability of dental care for lower-income people, a lack of mental health resources or inpatient chemical dependency treatment in our area, and how a large part of our healthcare resources are spent on preventable health issues that arise because of poor lifestyle choices. We also became aware that there are resources available that are underutilized. So as a first step responding to a very, very big issue, we decided we can develop a public relations campaign to promote healthy habits and the area resources that are available. And this will, of course, take a lot of collaborative effort between many entities in our county, but we are confident and look forward to seeing how this will come together in the months ahead. And among the many things that have come out of our collaborative philosophy and efforts, perhaps the most measurable so far is the success of the Bridges program, and I yield my remaining time to Dennis.
Thank you, Lauren. Well, on the behalf of the Healthy Community Collaborative, and we have several board members here in the audience, and the people of Morrison County, we certainly welcome you to our community. We thank you for being with us. If we're listening to us as we talk about some of our needs, but we share our uniqueness and accomplishments that we're very proud of. Mark and Elena, thank you for your observations about our community, the resources that we have because we're very proud of them, but the kind of community that we have because we believe, too, it's very warm and welcoming. The basic premise of a collaborative such as ours that focuses on health and well-being is those factors are impacted by a number of other factors, of personal lifestyle, socioeconomics, environment, relationships, genetic predisposition, as well as quality health care. So we take on ourselves of trying to address most of those components. Now, by any measure, our collaborative is new on the scene of our 150-year-old county community. In our first 5 years, we're learning and growing. We know we must be patient and deliberate, but very focused in our efforts to achieve the mission that Lauren spoke of. Being aware of the challenges is necessary, but building on our assets and strengths is what's essential. And that's what we need to do. We know we must listen to the voice of the community, and we must respond with action. And I think we do that. And I want to speak of the Bridges program as one example. About 2 years ago, concerns were expressed to the collaborative board about the unmet needs, mental health needs for counseling of some of the younger children in our county communities. Our local social services, public health, and schools came to the collaborative and identified about 50 youngsters age that they felt were in need and their issues were not being dealt with. Some of the issues of time delays, distance to services, demands on the parents and families in arranging for counseling, as well as lack of insurance coverage were identified as possible barriers. Through the resources of the collaborative, we addressed these identified needs, facilitated some planning and intervention response with a number of community partners that we work with. We were successful in receiving a grant that we call, for a program that we call Bridges. I've got some brochures if you would like. This grant came through the resources of St. Gabriel's Hospital and the Catholic Health Initiatives. We are now in the process, we've just finished year one of this program, we're in the process of continuing to coordinate Bridges for Youth, Family, and Community. Now, Bridges is a pilot program, this brochure, please.
It's a program providing the services of two full-time mental health practitioners serving in two separate elementary schools in two different communities. They're working with identified children and their families to provide daily mental health services reinforcement. And it's done within the context of the schools, which is somewhat unique. It's not brand new, but it's somewhat unique. But it's bringing together the resources of the school, the education system, and the mental health system. Bridges also provides another major component, which focuses on an evidence-based family support program. It's called FAST, if you've ever heard of it, Families and Schools Together. It's probably one of the premier programs across the state of Minnesota. Began about 20 years ago in Madison, Wisconsin. We're one of the only sites in the state of Minnesota that is providing the FAST programs. This works with families on an intensive 8-week family weekly meeting basis, and then it continues for 2 years of support and follow-up with families. The research that FAST has done in their evidence-based work is phenomenal. And our early outcomes to our work, both with families through the FAST program and our mental health work with schools, is certainly looking very promising. I want to share just one quick testimonial with you. Call it a Johnny story if you want. But we received this from some of the schools, the teachers that we work with. Johnny, of course, not his real name. He's a first grade student admitted to the Bridges program on referral from the school social worker and the teacher. Johnny had trouble keeping his hands off people, constantly interrupting, and overall disruptive to class. He was prone sometimes to stealing, lying, throwing temper tantrums, and refusing to follow directives. The teacher goes on to say that thanks to the Bridges program, Johnny's behavior improvement has been nothing short of amazing. His opening scores of 130 have dropped now to 30 points. We tried to make this very evidence-based process. To the second level, there haven't been any more tantrums, and he seems more able to fix his problems with less frustration. And another teacher commented that with 13 years of experience as a fifth grade teacher, I can't tell you how much this program would have helped countless other students over that time period. Many families simply cannot afford outside mental health services, and Bridges is an accessible option for them. This program is priceless, and every single elementary school should have that program. We were very blessed and pleased to hear those comments. On November 1st, coming up in about a week or so, we are being honored by the CenterCare Health Foundation in St. Cloud with the 2007 Spirit of Caring Award. This is given for the dedication and exemplary service, the community group collaboration toward improving health through education and service provision. We feel very pleased in this first year of the Bridges program to be awarded that honor. Now, there's been a measured benefit for sure for those students and their families and for the schools. But we know there's also been a benefit for the communities because Bridges operates with the support and the volunteerism of individuals, groups, organizations, and businesses that work in the communities. They have partnered with us, so they have a part, and they have a sense of accomplishment and pride also in the success of the Bridges program. Now, of course, comes the challenge of sustainability and replicability of this program. We're in the first year of the program. We were originally granted a 2-year grant. They have asked us to come back and invited us to apply for a third-year grant. So we believe we have 3 years to make this work. We have constantly been working on replicability. When we're finished after 3 years, we want to have a plan in place that all schools in our county community and all communities can take advantage of both the mental health and the FAST program. That's a challenge for us. It's a challenge for legislature, and we may be back to you as part of this, but for other organizations and foundations that help to supply the resources that makes the Bridges program operational. I have a couple other things I want to say quickly. Our collaborative, when we first began in 2003 and again in 2006, went to our community and we did community-wide visioning meetings. We asked people to come together and talk to us about what was good about our community, what were the challenges, and what were the visions they had. Now, we felt good about our process, but admittedly, we did not have the numbers of people that we would like to have had. We know that it's necessary for us to constantly be listening to the community and responding. And that's a practice that we always try to carry out. We've had some other issues brought to our collaborative within the last few months, and one of those is the issue of childhood obesity and healthy living for young children. Another is a concern about early childhood literacy, which we know makes a major impact for learners throughout their career. And another is concern about the numbers of high-risk families, low-income families and high-risk families of needing daycare and or child care and good help for those families. We recently had another issue brought to our attention today about concerns of gambling addiction. So we're having issues and concerns about community needs brought to us. We feel that is reinforcing for the work that we are trying to do. And I want to close by certainly thanking you, but I got to find my notes here. Okay, well, we don't do it alone. We do it with our community. We're a collaborative, and we're dependent on the community. We're a group of volunteers, and we need the synergy of our community, the energy and the input of our community, and you are part of our community also. We need that dialogue and that support with you, and we look forward to that in the future. So we thank you very much for your time and interest in hearing our story. Well, no, the mental health program is one that we contract with an organization out of Wilmer, Minnesota. That's Greater Minnesota. That's separate from FAST. The families that are involved with the mental health program can participate in FAST, but there are additional families in that program. FAST is called a program called FAST National out of Madison, Wisconsin. I can get you some information on that. That's, if you may know that, Representative Gottwald, that's a very strong program.
Yeah, I'm just curious as to how, more detail on how the
action process for going into the school to. Okay. Yeah, that process follows very similar to a process of a child and family would come into an outpatient clinic. The parents give full permission at all times to anyone coming in. There is always a mental health evaluation done by a mental health professional, a psychologist. If the child qualifies for mental health services by virtue of having a mental health diagnosis, the parent is then given the option to have their child in treatment within this school-based program. Absolutely, absolutely. The parent's in charge, just as if they went into a clinic in a community. Sure. Yes, we're very careful about that. Much of FAST right now is funded through the grant from Catholic Health Initiatives to the Bridges program. And FAST is not an inexpensive program. The startup costs are rather significant. We have been successful in getting a lot of community contributions that pick up part of the FAST cost. Our coordinator of the program is Michelle Andringa, and Michelle has a broad experience in working with families in early childhood special or family education. So she has gone to Madison, and she is now a trainer. So as we begin new FAST programs in our county community, Michelle can come and do the training. She can do the supervision, which will significantly reduce the cost to our own communities in our county. So it's really good.
Well, thank you for sharing.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Jack Peck, there you go, welcome, come on up. And Mr. Peck is with the hospital.
Can you all hear me? My voice is a little bit louder than most people's, but I want to include everybody. Sometimes I felt they were kind of left out. Should I use a microphone?
Yes, please.
Okay. First of all, good evening, and I thank everyone for being here. I understand you had a very nice trip through our new hospital. We're excited. We have our grand opening coming up on
Sunday at 12:30 with a dedication ceremony and an open house. If you can come back, might be the only opportunity that you will have to get into the operating rooms and some of the other places in the hospital that there is not much access to. As he said, my name is Jack Peck. I serve on the board of directors for St. Gabriel's Hospital. It's a 25-bed critical access hospital, and it's located right here in Little Falls. I'm a retired broadcaster, so I'm not used to working with microphones. Much of the interest and information during your tour this afternoon, you all heard about. Our hospital provides most of the traditional inpatient and outpatient services, such as diagnostics, like lab and radiology, as well as rehab services, respiratory care, surgery, and a myriad of other services. We also have a strong home care. We have a department, and a Little Falls campus includes a 118-bed nursing home, a 14-bed home for adults with developmental disabilities. We have a 60-unit senior housing complex. Albany Area Hospital and Medical Center is located approximately 35 miles southwest of here. Albany is a subsidiary of St. Gabriel's Hospital. The entire healthcare organizations, including Albany, includes 650 full and part-time employees. We are the second largest employer in Morrison County behind Camp Ripley. We have an annual budget of approximately $30 million, which includes $21 million in salaries. We provided nearly $400,000 in community benefits in the last fiscal year, which ended June 30th of 2007. Our healthcare organization is an affiliate of Catholic Health Initiatives, better known as CHI. A 100-plus facility healthcare organization that's based in Denver with facilities across the United States. Three other Minnesota healthcare organizations, St. Francis Home and St. Francis Medical Center in Breckenridge, Lakewood Health Center in Baudette, and St. Joseph Health Services in Park Rapids are also part of CHI. St. Gabriel's Hospital, as well as our sponsor, CHI, supports the goal that all Minnesotans should have health insurance coverage, with only 8% of the state's population without health insurance. Minnesota is uniquely positioned to achieve universal coverage. In Morrison County, despite being one of the poorest counties in the state, less than 5% of our residents do not have any health insurance. We urge legislators to ensure that the Health Care Access Fund is used for its intended purpose, to expand coverage and pay for an appropriate benefit set in the Minnesota Care Program. The fund currently has a projected surplus of $156 million for fiscal year 2008. Here in Morrison County, many of our residents work for small businesses that do not offer health insurance or own farms with limited net income available to be used to pay for health insurance. We want to make sure that Minnesota Care remains a viable option for our county residents. In addition to sharing your goal of universal coverage, we also recognize the need to help control the growth of health care costs. The American Hospital Association recently estimated the cost caring for three common chronic conditions, asthma, diabetes, and hypertension, at $30 billion a year. Clearly, we need to do more with preventative medicine and wellness programs. At St. Gabriel's Hospital, we are performing more health screenings than ever before. We have teamed up with both Walmart and Coburn Superstore to offer on-site blood pressure screening, and every other year we plan and conduct a large community health fair held in Little Falls Middle School. We also have an accredited diabetes education program to address that chronic condition. Proactive intervention programs have demonstrated that they can save money. However, with many of these current case management care models, our hospital doesn't achieve a positive bottom line. We credit it to community benefit and accept the fact that we will lose money. It would be nice if payment reform could encourage innovation with financial incentives. Despite our increased efforts at local health screenings, we still need policymakers to ensure that our emergency departments and healthcare infrastructure still receive adequate funding. ER coverage is extremely expensive for rural hospitals. No longer can we rely solely on our active staff to cover the ER. For many of today's physicians, it's simply a quality of life decision. Policymakers must, however, recognize that if we are successful in doing a better job with prevention and keeping people from hospitalizations, our emergency rooms and healthcare infrastructure will still need funding. Finally, I have three specific items that I would like to mention that are not unique to rural Minnesota, but definitely a major concern to us. Number one, Medicaid payments continue to be less than the cost to provide those services. In 2005, costs in excess of Medicaid and payments exceeded $330 million across the state. For many hospitals in rural Minnesota, there are simply no payers to shift the costs to. Raising prices on self-pay patients is neither just nor does it make good health policy. While we certainly support the mandate of moving forward with electronic health records, information technology is an enormous expense to all healthcare providers. Let's talk numbers. 15 years ago, our information technology department, of course that's when it was called data processing budget, was in the tens of thousands. This year, it is $1.2 million. At the same time, inpatient admissions have decreased, and this new expense has come out of an already tight budget. Let's move slowly. Please don't mandate electronic health records without providing some resources for smaller rural hospitals like St. Gabriel's Hospital to implement such mandates. Finally, a chronic labor shortage faces rural hospitals across the state. In the past, we've experienced difficulty recruiting and hiring skilled professionals in pharmacy and radiology, especially. Also, finding and retaining a registered nurse, surgical services manager, has been an ongoing challenge. We believe that the state should do more to target investments in our Minnesota State Colleges and University system, specifically to enhance healthcare training programs in greater Minnesota, where many employment opportunities actually exist. Maybe such training could be patterned after rural physician associate programs, which has been a great benefit to St. Gabriel's Hospital. Now, since we first participated in 1973, we've had a RPR AP medical student here every year. On behalf of the Governing Board of St. Gabriel's Hospital and the entire Morrison County medical community, I want to thank the House Health and Human Services Committee, Representative Al Doty, and all of the state legislators and staff for coming to Little Falls today. I appreciate your allowing me to share some of our concerns. Thank you.
Dr. Bernier, I'm sorry, please go ahead and introduce yourself to the record if you could.
Thank you. I'm Nick Bernier. I'm a family physician, actually from the Brainerd area, but I just finished the day over in the Pierce Family Clinic, where I've been going for about 20 years, taking care of some of those farm folks that don't have insurance. Al had asked me here to talk about a subject that some of the presenters here have touched on a little bit, but one that is sort of near and dear to my heart. I've been in practice for a little over 30 years. I've been in the ER for 20 years, delivered hundreds of babies, been involved in our mental health team for a number of years, take care of farmers with and without insurance, some of which have mental health problems. Our rural health system is sick. You've heard that. I'm also involved with Ray Christensen and the Duluth Clinic. I've helped educate about 20 RPAP students over the years, and it also has helped Brainerd. Just a quick plug for that. The difficulty nowadays with getting a medical student who does the RPAP program to go into primary care is economics. I can't claim poverty. I'm a salaried physician. But when you're coming out of medical school and you've got $150,000 in debt and you want to buy a house and you have to buy into a practice, a salary that isn't as big as your mortgage doesn't allow you to pay all three of those, and so it's real attractive to go into a specialty. When you saw those numbers of physicians going into training in family medicine and pediatrics and internal medicine, the internal medicine bars, you'll notice if you look at your program, didn't drop that much, but none of them are going into rural primary care. They're all going into specialties, becoming cardiologists or gastroenterologists or whatever. So whatever you can do as a legislature to help go upstream, fund people's medical education if they'll practice for 5 years in a rural community. And sorry, Al, I needed to give the – he wanted me to talk about mental health, and I will. The mental health, rural mental health thing, if the regular mental health system is sick, the rural mental health is in crisis and it's broke. You mentioned, Mr. Schoenbaum mentioned, if you went off the road in your car somewhere around in rural Minnesota today, what would happen? Well, you know, like the critical access hospital here, the ones in Crosby Staple, they do a great job. They package people up, they scan them, they send them, they get them choppered out wherever you need to go. They do a great job. Now, if you're traveling along that road and your loved one with you has a serious mental health problem and they derail, that's a different story. You're going to spend hours or days in a rural emergency department while they try and find a place and a psychiatrist for you. That doesn't matter whether you're in Little Falls or Brainerd or where you are. We have a 22-bed inpatient mental health unit in Brainerd. It's usually full. We're having trouble finding psychiatrists. Psychiatrists have the same issue. They get paid for the same thing I do. They get paid about 40% less. And especially when you're talking pediatric or adolescent psychiatry, if you're that psychiatrist, you don't have a patient. You have a kid, you have two parents, you have a teacher, and you have a social worker. And you see them at great mental anguish and exercise and work for 40% less than what a primary care physician sees a health care visit for. That is really broke. And so that's why we have one of the lowest psychiatrist to population ratios in the United States in Minnesota. We also have about 60% of the average number of beds per population that the rest of the country has. Mental health has been an easy target. It's hard to measure. I can measure a heart attack. I can measure a broken bone. I can measure a potassium. I can measure an EKG. But I can't measure how sick your loved one is if they're mentally ill. And so it's an easy target to say, you know, how sick are they? Do they need to be in the hospital? A factor from the state level, one of my pet peeves, has been the activity that's happened at the state over the last few years in completely closing down basically the state-operated system, the state hospitals, if you will. 2% of our population, our growing population, is seriously and persistently mentally ill. How many here think we ought to euthanize them? How many here think we ought to take care of them in some form? Well, we're not. Okay? We're not. There's a big deficit there. There's no psychiatrist. The medications and the care of such folks, other than some of the farm folks that I'm still able to help with assistance from my psychiatrist friends, those medications and their care is complex beyond my training. A rural primary care physician can really no longer do all this. I need some help for my patients, and when they land in the ER, if you talk to the people in the cities, they measure this, the ER stays for mental health patients trying to get placement in a bed. They measure it in days, not hours, days. And they have special units set aside with rubber rooms for people that are self-destructive. One of the catch-22 is we have, because we have a mental health unit at St. Joe's Brainerd, is that we are bound by a federal law called COBRA EMTALA. Some of you may be familiar with that. That means if we have the capacity, a bed and the capability and the capacity in a position to treat a person in that unit, we can't turn down a referral from anywhere. Okay? We are reviewing every month in committee with the few psychiatrists we have, dozens of people that we've turned away, sometimes from Little Falls, sometimes from the city, sometimes from Rochester, because we didn't have the capacity or the capability to treat them. So we spin our wheels doing quality improvement, if you will, because we have to prove that we couldn't handle that patient, because otherwise the state comes around and accuses us of not complying with the law. Well, it's a real problem. For us, it's a mission. Catholic Health Initiatives is a great outfit. I personally work for the Sisters of St. Benedict out of Duluth. They own us and have for 100 years, and you guys have been here for 100 years. So I think we have some of the same problems. But some of us think that the state of Minnesota may have, and to a certain extent, abdicated its responsibility to be a safety net for mental health, especially for adults and adolescents. Kids are a whole different story. This program you guys were talking about in the school thing is really attractive to me. I would like to catch mental health problems upstream if I had a druther. I don't often have that druther, but the problem is there's a lot of folks out there that are seriously and persistently mentally ill, and right now that system is very broke. I understand that we have 16-bed community-based mental health units, one of which went up in Baxter, another one went up in Wadena. Right now they have less capabilities than we do at St. Joe's. We are not set up to handle seriously and persistently mentally ill, violent patients, and they are less capable than we are. The last several that we've had of those patients, we ended up sending thousands of dollars of our expense, because these people don't have any insurance, to Fargo. We're sending them to another state. That's what we've done. This is broke, folks. So I'm not suggesting that we reinstitute asylums, but there are folks who are in and out of ours and other institutions enough that we need some sort of alternative to what's going on now. This is cost shifting in the extreme. These folks they can't advocate for themselves. They're just incapable of doing it. We're not addressing it. You're cost shifting to us. We have to raise our prices to the farmers who don't have insurance if we're going to pay for mental health to subsidize it. We have to subsidize psychiatrists. So, a pitch for mental health. The rural health system is sick. The rural mental health system is broke.
Thank you very much, sir. Ms. Varna, is that right? Or June Varna. You want to come up to the microphone?
When I saw Al Doty at a farmers union meeting last week, he mentioned that perhaps I could share with you part of the experience that we had with the nursing home problem. So I've
can
served.
You just, say your name into the microphone if you could. No, it's on.
Okay. And my name is in the sheet here, so that's part of it.
Just for recording purposes.
I'm June Varner.
Thank you.
15498 83rd Street in Little Falls, Minnesota. A farmer and resident of District 12B, which elected Dal Doty to the legislature. I want to bring several health issues to you this evening. Last year, I was fortunate to be able to spend some time in Austin, Minnesota at St. Mark's Lutheran Home, helping to care for Martha Dahl. I'm attaching a letter her son, Stan Estes, sent in January 2006 to the administration of that facility about her care. Currently, she is in good spirits, but has not recovered her mobility from a stroke. And part of the problems that I talk about in the letter they attached is inappropriate diet and insufficient care. Note at the beginning of page 2, he talks about essential fatty acids. In our discussion with food service there, we were told that they were prohibited from serving foods with fats. They only serve 1% milk, low-fat yogurt, and margarine. We feel that high-quality fats like whole milk, butter, and full-fat yogurt that could contain essential fat should be served. In response to our concerns about enough protein, they encouraged Martha to drink the soy-based protein drinks. This leads to my cat story. As a longtime farmer, I knew that legumes such as soy have estrogenic qualities. I had a lot of wild cats on the farm, and about 5 years ago, in order to keep them from reproducing, I started feeding a soy-based dog food as part of their diet. While it worked to keep the younger females from getting pregnant, the mature females still had kittens. Most of those kittens died within hours of being born, but a few survived. One of the females was about 9 months old when she looked pregnant and kept getting bigger. When the pregnancy seemed too long, I took her to the vet, and she was full of a very spidery, invasive ovarian cancer that the vet had never seen before. The cat had to be put down. Two of the adult females also died of cancer. One had a tumor growing out of her ear, and the other appeared to have ovarian cancer. Last year, I stopped feeding the soy, trapped the females, and got them spayed. There is a considerable body of independent research that indicates the estrogenic qualities of soy are carcinogenic. While I personally think the protein in these drinks is denatured and mostly indigestible, I think you should take a serious look at prohibiting nursing homes from serving brands that contain soy. The next point I want to make to reiterate is the issue Stan mentions about staffing in nursing homes. The dedicated ladies and gentlemen who serve as aides to the residents are always smiling, gracious, and respectful when they help them. Out in the hallway is different, and we see how exhausted and overworked they are. In Stan's letter, he indicated the aides' recommendation to have extra help for the morning work. Almost every resident needs to be bathed, dressed, fed, helped to the bathroom, and back to rest within 4 hours. Some of these residents are not well, and serving them is a struggle. When they are short-staffed, it is very difficult for the aides to provide basic needs in a timely manner. And sometimes Stan's mother had to wait a half an hour to go to the bathroom, and she's a two-assist, so two people had to help her to do that. And she would be beside herself in tears when she had to wet herself because they couldn't come. I implore you to require these facilities to have appropriate on-call staffing. This might also help to encourage aides to stay on the job and reduce turnover. The last point I want to mention is the obesity epidemic. I'm attaching a short document that Stan and I researched that looks at the connection between insulin resistance and estrogen dominance. Human fat is saturated fat. Humans need to eat saturated fats and should avoid vegetable oils if they want to be healthy and reach their optimum weight. And I thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Is there anybody else who's interested in? Welcome. And just let us know your name when you get to the mic.
Roman Watuki, Little Falls, Minnesota. Retired, as past union leader for 25 years, dealt with a negotiating committee of 50 contracts with dealt with health care, also served on the Steelworker Health and Welfare Board of Directors for 6 years. One of the real issues I'm concerned about is the cost of health care and how it can be dealt with. Presently, 18 months ago, I was paying $258 a month. Less than that, 6 months ago, I was paying $258 a month for my wife's coverage, which was covered underneath COBRA. At that time, I went off of COBRA, applied for open market health care. Premium price they stated me was $360. To the same carrier that I was covered underneath my former employer. As you all know, and you do a little research on it, anybody over 55 years old, most insurance companies, whether it be Blue Cross, Medicare, or whatever, find the excuse to deny coverage. So that came, it was denied. So I got thrown into Minnesota Comp for my wife. That comes up to $437 a month. What I'm suggesting is the state got to come up with some type of pooling process, or as we did when I was on the Steelworker Health and Welfare Fund, we blue carded. We sold insurance nationwide to union members. We sold a Cadillac plan, which came in $100 a month billed in this area, below than any area, any agents could sell us in this area. And we did it on a nationwide basis. There's benefits to pooling. There's benefits to single payer. You can negotiate your prices. Just a benefit. But also what you've got to look at is when you have to get into this, go out and buy a private plan. In my case, I went off a comp, wouldn't apply to general. The premium went up, which is respectable. But if you take a look at the research I did on a local level, most people who go out there and try and purchase a single plan or private plan on their own is going to end up in Minnesota Comp, which is another $80 a month higher. And I think that can be addressed with the legislature to cure some of that problem through a pooling process or whatever. Presently, I feel myself in fair financial condition. Presently, underneath that, with a $2,000 deductible plan, my wife's health care and my Medicare, I'm paying close to $700 a month and projected a month out of my Social Security check, got to go for health care coverage, which is obscene in my. And I think that can be dealt with some type of statewide plan or whatever, or single payer or group pooling, and that cost can be reduced considerable. I had experience with the Steelworkers Health and Welfare Plan, and we did it. It's possible, and it can be done if you just want to take the effort to go ahead and do it and negotiate a good plan.
Thank you.
Is there anybody else that, yeah, welcome.
My name is Sandra Driscoll, and I work for Morrison County Public Health. And I want to say that you've already taken a big step this year. You passed the Smoke-Free Minnesota, and that's going to make a big impact on chronic disease. And I just hope that we can now take a look at some of the other things that might be helpful. Now that we've done that one, let's start working on seat belts as a primary legislative act to get particularly our young people who are driving pickup trucks, and that's the highest accident rate without seat belts, and we'll probably be able to make another big impact on the cost of health care. Thank you.
Anybody else? Well, thank you all for coming tonight and for sharing your comments, because it really is incredibly helpful, I think, to all of us to hear this information and what you're doing and seeing. You know, I think the thing that I guess I would say I've taken away from the last 2 days is clearly there are some unique challenges that rural Minnesota has, workforce challenges being one that comes to mind right away. But it's also been amazing to see how lucky you are in many ways with the two places we've been, Hibbing and here, the facilities that you have available and the people there are really incredible. And so you should feel very fortunate in that regard, I think. But at the end of the day, it's my sense is that although there are unique challenges, the issue of making healthcare affordable, meaningful healthcare, I suppose, affordable to everyone, really is something that all Minnesotans, I think, have a strong interest in and where we can really make a big difference. So thank you for helping us as we move in that direction. And anybody else have anything they want to close with? Okay. Well, thank you all for coming. Have a good night. Oh, and thanks to Al for inviting us up here, too. It was really helpful.